Turn me down over there. All right, cool. Let me just go ahead and kick off just a brief introduction, and then we'll kind of dive into the topic. With this size of group and with the importance your companies are in terms of partnership around this topic, I do want to make sure that this is as interactive as you'd like it to be. I know we have a number of more sort of deep dive sessions later this afternoon, but generally I've found if one person has a question, more than one person has that same question, it's just not as comfortable generally asking that. So please feel free, and if the questions go on too long, I'll start bucketizing them a little bit, but I definitely want this to be an interactive experience, because if I just stand up here and talk for 2 hours and you start to drift off, that won't be any fun for anybody. So what we're here to talk about, obviously, is direct access, and I'll just do a brief introduction of how I've come to be here today. So I spent kind of 4 years in the Microsoft Security Group, working with MSRC, SWI, the Security Response Center, as part of the team that helped invent kind of Patch Tuesday here within Microsoft. And in 2007, I joined the network security team inside of Windows division as we were getting ready to develop Windows 7. And as part of that, I then took over responsibility for program management duties for direct access and really helped guide the engineering team through delivery of this feature. And besides myself here today, we also have members of our engineering team. So raise your hands, guys. So they're here as well to dive into it, both from a development test side. So I appreciate you guys coming today. And hopefully I'll be able to keep you guys awake as well, because I know you've seen this thing like 1,000 times. So let's keep going here. Quick level set. How many have seen one of the general sort of direct access presentations from the web or from a conference or these kind of things before? Just quick show of hands. Okay, only a couple. That's actually, I thought we might have some more repeats there. So actually, it's good that you know the majority of us, this will be new content. So what I'll do is start off with just an overview of what we call our core infrastructure optimization model. It's kind of a language we're using to describe a lot of our server functionality across the entire server suite and how direct access kind of plays a role into that. Then I'll dive into the direct access technology itself. I'll then try to get as detailed as you guys want me to get. The deck itself is fairly detailed, but we can certainly go much deeper if you'd like to. And then we'll just kind of wrap it up, and then I think I'll be standing in between you and lunch, and so we'll try to get it wrapped up. Okay. All right. So this first section is on this what's called the core infrastructure optimization model. And this is this infrastructure optimization model is something that our field has been using to describe to talk to customers about how to use Microsoft products to help accelerate whatever business problem they're trying to solve. We found that when our field and our sales force would talk with customers, if we approached it from the point of view of, well, here's the great things that this server would do for you, and here's the great things that SQL would do for you, and here's the great things this product would do for you, it wasn't really resonating as well with customers as if we took a second and tried to figure out, well, what is the business problem they're trying to solve? What is the state of their organization in terms of their ability to accept various technology solutions? And then made sure that we positioned the technologies that and the products we had available to them aligned with where they're at. You know, some organizations are simply not ready for some of the automation technologies, for example, that we might want to take advantage of here. And so understanding and kind of focusing on the customer, the problems they're having, and where they're at in their, shall we say, development cycle in terms of technology is really critical. And so there was a large study that we did comprising about 15,000 customers, and we created this model that we used to talk to customers. And there's basically four buckets that we have to describe our customers, from basic, standardized, rationalized, and dynamic. And this is a framework that we use across all of our product sets. So if you look at SQL or System Center Manager or all of the different server products, we try to describe what is the value of a particular product based off of which category a customer might be in their development of information technology. So you might have a customer who is very, very, to overuse the word basic, in their development, meaning in terms of what servers they have, what automated processes they have, and what can this product do for that customer that is at that development point. It's going to be very different than what a product could do for a customer if, for example, they have very sophisticated management systems, can auto-deploy updates throughout their organization, and really can react very quickly in an environment. So In terms of direct access, we're looking at sort of network access, remote access. We want to think about kind of where customers are at in relation to these things. Some customers are very basic in their password policies, for example. Some customers don't even have password rotation policies. You know, other customers, for example, you know, have learned the evils of this approach and mandate, you know, oh, you have to change your password every 35 days, every 45 days, but they have no enforcement mechanism. Other customers actually have purchased technologies that allow them to do reporting on that, see if passwords have been rotated or not, force password rotation to occur, and then take it to the next step of actually requiring strong passwords that, you know, the very common passwords we have that are very weak or your kid's name, you know, aren't acceptable, and we actually have strength policies, and then all the way down to organizations that require two-factor authentication. And I won't go through every single one of these, but this is just kind of a framing model we use to describe our products, and we think that direct access as a set of technology really helps to move a customer from kind of the basic, you know, through to our standardized, through to rational, through to dynamic. Because what it allows them to do is to take a set of policies that they might want to apply in their environment and be able to leverage those from multiple topologies, meaning that they can use these policies when folks are on the local network as well as those same policies are on the remote network. It helps to really enable a very dynamic sort of infrastructure inside of an organization. So this is the point kind of the next slide, is we want to move kind of how we talk to customers in terms of securing their networks from the model of the past, which I tend to use as what's called the castle model. So you would tend to build a big moat around your castle. You would build this perimeter defense really, really strong. But typically on the inside, you know, it was kind of a soft and juicy sort of rich target environment. There was not a lot of controls within the organization. And a lot of customers have told us that they're moving away from that sort of castle and moat sort of network design. And instead, we want to think about, well, who are the principals that are involved in the network? What do they need access to as the key thing that we use to secure our network? And where they're coming from is kind of a second order of sort of importance. That regardless of where the person is at on the network, that they have access to a certain set of things, and that when they go remote, that access is still available to them, and we have consistent security access models that work in both. An example for where this breaks is things like 802.1x. You might have organizations that have made very big investments to secure their wireless networks, but those wireless security investments don't do you a whole lot of good when you're sitting at a Starbucks remotely accessing the network. And so what we want to think about are technologies and techniques that are able to be mobile, if you will, and transient, just like our users are, as they float in and out of the network. We want to be able to support strong authentication for the users, and then tie this policy to the identity of the user and what they're trying to access in our data center, in our network, regardless of where they're at. And we want to make sure that regardless of where they're coming from, that we have complete end-to-end security possible for that potential customer. So you're going to hear this phrase kind of repeated a lot. Policies based on identity, not based on location. How many of you are familiar with the work of an organization called the Jericho Forum? Yeah. So a lot of this thinking is not something that necessarily that even Microsoft per se invented. There's a large sort of groundswell of effort out there in the industry around this concept. Some folks call it reperimeterization, some call it deperimeterization. But it's a mind shift as a way to secure your network that many companies are evolving to. So how does direct access kind of play into this picture? It's kind of the second challenge here. So as organizations are looking at this sort of reperimeterization sort of model, you know, we have to think about why are they doing this? Well, one of the reasons is because of the increasing porous perimeter. Microsoft, for example, and other companies have technologies that allow seamless access to certain applications or certain facilities inside the organization, but they do that by poking holes through that edge. Like, how many of you are familiar with Outlook's capability to use what's called RPC over HTTP? Nope, yeah. So it's kind of a way that Outlook can talk to an Exchange server through that edge of the network. So you've poked a hole for Outlook, if you will. Other applications do similar things. And so what you end up with is an organization that it might have a half a dozen different ways that their employees or their business partners can get through that edge And each one of those holes have a separate auditing system, accounting system, reporting system, and it becomes very, very challenging to manage this. And if you look at even Microsoft's own products, we started going down this path of these what we call per application sort of gateways, if you will. So for example, the Outlook's capability of RPC over HTTP evolved into the terminal services or remote desktop's capability to do the same thing. Now you can do remote desktop, you know, through RPC over HTTP by setting up a remote desktop gateway. It's another example of these edge services. But what's the long-term strategy around that? Is every application going to get their own per app gateway at the edge to enable these experiences? And how are we going to manage that over the long term? So this is a problem that we're facing and organizations are facing. And so how can we help consolidate this edge story? How we can help consolidate the reporting and auditing that kind of goes along with it? And be able to support the sort of globalization capability of our users are just floating around the world, the workloads are floating around the world. You might take a project today that's manned here or staffed here, and tomorrow it's someplace else. And how do we enable that sort of fluid sort of network design in our customer environments? Okay. So this is where Direct Access is designed to help. Instead of looking at Direct Access as a replacement for a remote access technology, the way we think about Direct Access is actually kind of the opposite. We actually look at it from the point of view of taking the network and actually extending that out to where the users are located. So instead of finding increasingly creative ways to allow the users to remote into the network, we're just going to take that network to them and actually create this bidirectional communication capability to the users regardless of where they are located. The benefit of this approach is that we can then have a unified policy framework that we apply to the users, regardless of where they're physically at, that will always be enforced. It also then creates a single communication channel that other applications can leverage instead of inventing their own per-app gateways. So instead of setting up four or five or six different systems at the edge for each of these apps, you can consolidate that down to a single edge presence that you can then centrally manage and monitor and have auditing around. And that allows you then to consider this edge consolidation capability. So also from a total cost of ownership of managing your edge, you also can kind of reduce this a little bit. So what I'm going to do, though, at this point, is I'm going to hop into a demo. How would you guys like to see a demo? Would a demo be cool? Because I have a bunch more slides that dive into the technology, but I think it's always a lot more interesting if I can actually have you see it and then refer back to it. Now, Direct Access is always tricky to demo because I'm here on the corporate network. And so part of the benefit of Direct Access is that it provides seamless access when I'm off the corporate network. So what I've actually done here to show you my laptop is that I've connected to our network called the Microsoft Guest Network. So most of you who have laptops are probably on this network. So this is literally a equivalent like you're sitting at Starbucks. So you have unfettered sort of internet connectivity. I have no direct access to our corporate network. So this kind of shows that there's nothing up my sleeve, if you will, in terms of how I'm connecting here. I'm literally using the public network. You can see the network location manager sort of profile that will look the same regardless of where I'm at. But the neat part about Direct Access is that we also want to make it seamless to the user and completely transparent. So as soon as I logged in to my machine here, and I brought up Outlook, for example, I've had to do sort of nothing else in terms of user experience. All I've done is that I've logged in, I've brought up Outlook, and here I have some links to sort of internal resources. Now, the typical user experience at this point would be, oh, I have to remember that's an internal link to something on our internal network. I have to know to then dial up my VPN client and then connect to my network. And then in many cases, I go through a remediation experience. I think many of you sell NAP and NAC kind of products, right? And one thing we hear from a lot of customers is that there's a vicious circle that occurs with some of these environments where if they know they have to dial up, if you will, and they know they're going to have to get patches as part of that process, and that's going to take 10 minutes, then they just won't do it, right? They'll wait until they have more time, if you will, and it creates an environment where users kind of hide off the network longer and longer and longer. The idea here is that a user doesn't have to make that choice. They would click this link just like they clicked that link back at the office, and it's just available to them without any sort of additional sort of steps or user experience. So this is literally our internal purchasing site that we use for purchase management. Let's take a look at another link. So, for example, if you want to get more information about direct access, well, we have a public site I can view, and I can click here to bring that up, just like it would be if I was directly surfing the internet. But I also have an internal version of that. So if you look at the link here, it literally is just a short name to internal SharePoint site that we use for our internal field and Salesforce to communicate about direct access. And I don't know if you saw what was happening there, but it actually did a lookup for the IP address. It was redirected to another URL, which is also an internal URL, and it just worked. So we didn't have to train the user in this case to do something different in order to connect back to the network than they would normally have done when they're using the network physically, when they're on site. And now, that's kind of the inbound experience, if you will. But I said that wasn't really the big push for direct access, right? I mean, there are some technologies from other companies that create, you know, seamless VPN kind of auto dial kind of experiences that do some of this, if you will. The real benefit, one of the other major benefits of direct access from our point of view is that it actually creates a seamless bidirectional pathway between the network and the client. So let me give you an example of this. Besides the, you know, the web surfing example, let me go ahead and take this to the next level of applications. I have a shortcut here that actually is going to link me to my desktop back at my office. So literally my desktop back in building 27. And if I look at the path here, I can see I'm using a standard sort of SMB link. I haven't had to configure anything on the edge for, you know, extranet web publishing or reverse proxies or anything like that. I've just used the standard sort of capability of the network. And I have a file here that I've opened up. I'm going to say this. I'm going to edit this locally. Now, I also have a location on my local laptop. So, to show the directory here. So, literally, it's on my local hard drive. See, demo laptop. All right. And I got a file here. And I'll open this up. And I can say file on the laptop. So, everyone with me so far? I have a file on the server, and I got a file on the client. So, what I'm going to do on the file on the server is just, I'm just show you, I'm editing this file. I'm going to save that. And now I'm going to remote desktop into my machine back at my office. And so literally, I can show my remote desktop session. I'm now remote desktoped into my machine at my office. And here is the shortcut to that location on my local, now on my local hard drive. You can see the path, see, you know, D data. I can open the file up, and I can see that the file has been edited. Okay, but again, that's still kind of a client inbound thing, right? You know, maybe not as interesting, all right? So I'll go ahead and edit that and save that. Okay. What would be really cool is if I could connect back over that network to that client machine. So here, from my desktop, I've actually pinged my laptop in real time, and you can see we use an actual V6 address for that communication to come back, even though I haven't had to deploy V6 on the public network or V6 fully within my corporate perimeter. So you can see how that worked. So that's pretty cool, isn't it? Come on. Right, that's pretty cool. Right? Bidirectional pathway back to the client. But I can tell you're not that impressed. So let me go ahead and open something else up. Like, for example, a SMB share. So now what I've just now done is open this SMB share up across the internet off the local hard drive on my machine, and here's the file on the laptop. There we go. And we politically correct, right? All right. So now if I minimize remote desktop session and go back to my actual local machine, you can see again my local folder here. There I can see the remote file has been edited by the network. And this machine, all I did was turn it on, logged in, connected to the internet. And this bidirectional pathway was opened up. So you can just sit here and think about the possibilities that we've just enabled in terms of help desk folks on side of the corporate network, being able to help remotely users through remote assistance, remote desktop, the ability for systems at the corporate network being able to push updates and patches and fixes to my machine as long as I have an internet connection. And so the idea is that it moves us from a world where the client makes a choice about connecting back to the network and gets remediated as part of that, to as long as they're connected to the internet, they're always up to date, they're always healthy, they're always manageable. And so now the corporate administrator can treat this remote device just like they treated a local device physically on-site at their corp. They don't have to manage that device any different in terms of health state or capabilities. You had a question?
So in your email example, when you clicked on the website,
yeah. Yeah, that was kind of tricky, how we figured that out. So I actually have a slide on this later. It's called the network, the name resolution policy table. Right? And we literally made changes to DNS in order to make this functionality work. And what we did was configure a namespace as a preferred namespace when Direct Access is configured. So that by default, what it will try to do is take any short name and actually map that against a namespace back in the corporation and do a name resolve against that namespace. And so for example,
so you changed the priority order, so you had Microsoft.com as a resolution first.
That's correct. That's correct. Okay. And this is why this solution was kind of tricky to build, because we had to make changes kind of, you know, through numerous places throughout the operating system in order for the end-to-end scenario to work. So another question.
So if I'm not using the short names, I'm using a regular long name,
yeah,
where internally I'd have a separate DNS server that handles me internal records as opposed to external records, how are we going to solve that issue?
Yeah. So the way it works is that we take the namespaces, for example, like star.corp.microsoft.com, which is an internal namespace, right? And we say this is the particular DNS server internally that would be used to resolve that name, for example. And so in your example where you have internal namespace different than external namespace, I think is what you were saying, we have that fully configurable in the environment.
And V4 to V6?
So yeah, we'll talk about V4 to V6. But what happens is we have the capability of handling a transition between V6 to V4 in terms of the communication of the information back to the internal network, and then there's a separate process that occurs to handle the V4 to V6 DNS transition. And we'll talk about that in a minute. I'm just going to go on. Go ahead.
I wanted to address the portion of the question that was seemed to be about if you need to put your internal names and make them resolvable from anyone on the internet, and that's not quite the case. You can redirect the query to an internal DNS server, which is still secured, so you don't need to deploy a new DNS server on the internet to host those names.
It sounded like your filter was going to take that traffic anyway and decide to send it to another DNS server.
No, we'll walk through the process. We'll go step by step on how the name resolution worked. Because I think it's a great question, but the slide where will help a little bit.
Okay.
All right. So was that pretty cool? You like that? Neat? All right. So so the point here on direct access for us is that it's more than just remote access. It's potentially a fundamental shift in how we're talking to customers about how to manage their networks, how to keep them those clients on those networks healthy, up to date, and have secure control of what they have access to in a uniform way, regardless of where they are physically at. So it's always on, meaning that it's simple now for the users. They don't have to think about doing something different. We've gotten feedback from customers that training the users on these client experiences, there's a high cost associated with it, high support desk experience associated with it, and so it simplifies that. Because they're always up to date, meaning they're always reachable by system center manager, you know, whatever sort of management system you use, Tivoli, et cetera, they can always be healthy. So when that patch comes out, you deploy that patch internally within your environment, and it goes out to even remote clients. You don't have to wait until to catch them when they dial in into your network environment. So the idea here is that it decreases patch miss rates, increases the level of client health and integrity throughout your environment, potentially in near real time. Access policies, as we said, the idea here is a consistent access control model. You can leverage things like NAP and NAC in order to make sure the clients are also healthy, in order to access the rest of the network while still allowing them to have access to what is in effect a portion of your network or a quarantine network that they would need to be remediated. in order over direct access. So we have full NAP integration, NAP NAC integration, third-party SHA shivs are supported if you have products that are in that area. And then the whole all this communication has been authenticated both from client to the edge of the network, as well as potentially from the client all the way to the inside of the network to the endpoint server, depending upon the capabilities of that endpoint server. And I'll kind of walk through how we can do that. So the catchphrase is, so most of your VPN products today connect the user to the network. Direct access actually extends the network to the computer and the user. Okay. So I've kind of went through then some of these differences between direct access and VPNs. We have a slide kind of dedicated to really try to drive that point home. And that is that it's automatic. There's nothing the user has to do. It automatically then makes that client reachable. We have the capability of taking what has been somewhat of a dichotomy in the past. Either you're using a traditional IPsec VPN product that has, you know, really strong authentication and access controls to it, but doesn't work from all network environments. So for example, behind, in what we call captive portal scenarios, behind corporate proxy servers or traditional VPNs, IPsec VPNs wouldn't work there. So that's where you typically see your SSL VPNs kind of fill the gap. But they have their own set of deployment challenges, you know, for customers, and don't necessarily have the same level of authentication that you might have with IPsec. What we do is actually bring those things together and have IPsec able to transit over and through SSL proxies so that you can get the best of both worlds there. So, and we can go, and we'll have slides kind of going through that in more detail. As I said, we support end-to-end authentication as well as end-to-edge as kind of the terminology we use, and that's kind of a key differentiating factor. The benefit of this approach is that when the client is physically inside the network, you can be securing that internal network communication as well, either integrity or encryption. And however, direct access is a Windows 7 client feature for us. So it's not something that we're backporting to Vista. It's not something we're backporting to Windows XP. And so we still have our traditional and working with our partners, third-party VPN products. And we're not necessarily trying to talk customers completely out of the VPN sort of solution, but it's simply trying to then scope to where we think it's appropriate now. And for us, our down-level clients will still need VPN access. And so we fully imagine direct access will have to work kind of side-by-side with the VPN clients that are out there for a number of years. Also, because one of the premises of this is that it always is manageable, always up to date, always healthy, we have focused it on domain joined Windows 7 PCs, meaning that non-domain joined PCs are not something that we support today with direct access. And we've heard both positive and constructive feedback on that point as well, and so I have later slides that can talk about maybe some partner opportunities there. One of the issues that you run into is when you start thinking about administrators pushing, you know, updates out to clients, if they're non-domain joined, you know, are they corporate managed assets at that point? And what are the permissions that you might have, for example, to do that for home PCs and various things? And so it's a little more tricky in terms of a policy. Okay. So the earlier customer feedback has been very positive in the fact that this comes as part of the Windows Server standard SKU. And as part of our Windows 7 Enterprise or Ultimate Client SKUs, it presents a fairly good cost savings over what customers might be using today. And because of the way we're changing literally how they think about managing their PCs and managing their networks, it allows a lot of very interesting scenarios and a reduction of total cost of ownership. So you, in theory, you don't necessarily need to think about having those RPC over HTTP servers sitting there on the edge, for example, and continuing this sort of per-app sort of model. You can consolidate that edge, create some cost savings there. And so in both my Outlook example and my remote desktop example, I was just going through a direct access server to get back to the network. Okay. So let's dive into the technical stuff. So how do we make this work? So the three big pieces, if you will, of the direct access pie are going to be that we're using IPv6 connectivity end-to-end in order to create universal addressability of the client and the systems inside. This is typically one of the big problems you have with today in the V4 world, is that you run into address-based collisions. And so we're using V6 as a mechanism to help us solve that problem. We then secure everything end-to-end with IPsec, And we help IPsec out with SSL when we're behind captive portals, but we have a consistent data protection in a sort of story for auditing. And then we have to solve all the naming problems. DNS and NRPT are the components we use to solve these. And I have a slide on each of these that we're going to kind of dig into the details. Okay. So first, connectivity. So we kind of put a flag in the sand. Direct access requires IPv6. But then we say, well, you don't really need IPv6. And here's why. Even though we're using V6 between our clients and our potential endpoints, we know the world is not necessarily there yet. And so we support a variety of transition technologies that allow us to take an IPv6 packet, put it inside of an IPv4 packet to get it over these boundaries where native V6 isn't available. And I'll have a slide that will kind of walk through kind of the packet flow. So we'll use these IPv6 transition technologies between the client and the direct access server. If you don't have native IPv6 inbound connectivity and you don't happen to be sitting at a Starbucks in Japan, then inside the network, we also use a variety of transition technologies if your backend supports that. And for true V4 only clients, we can work with additional devices that will do the V4 to V6 protocol translation. And so literally you would not be doing any V6 here at all. We'd be using in-place V4 infrastructure. But as far as the direct access server and the clients know, it looks, because of this device, like it's a V6 endpoint. So it's called a NAT-PT or a NAT-64 device. Okay, so far so good? We're going to kind of dive into here in more detail. One point I want to make before we kind of go into the detail, and there's a whole session on this later, so I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this, and that's how the Microsoft product that we're selling called UAG, or Unified Access Gateway, is able to layer on top of the core server direct access capabilities and help complete the scenario in a couple cases. As we said in that last slide, there's that NAT-PT, NAT-64 device that is needed in order to connect to a native V4 only resource. Windows Inbox doesn't provide that today. So the UAG product provides that component, or you could work with third-party versions of that component as well. The other thing that we wanted to do was that since Direct Access only works for Windows 7 clients, and we know we're going to have down-level clients, we wanted to make it really super easy for customers to have remote access, a story that's integrated for all of their operating systems. And so the UAG product actually provides both DA connectivity as well as VPN connectivity on the same server for the entire sort of client operating system base that's available there. And it leverages the existing or the engine that was developed for the ISA server product. I mean, some of you probably might be familiar with ISA, to upgrade the firewall on the Direct Access server itself to a kind of an EL4 certified firewall that's shipped now as part of the TMG product line. So that's kind of how UAG kind of works together with Direct Access, kind of sits on top of the Direct Access engine, upgrades the internal firewall capabilities, as well as provides integrated down-level support capabilities for operating systems. So we can get to those V4 endpoints from all of the operating systems that we have available. Okay, so let's kind of walk through some of the nuts and bolts. Yes, good question.
The non-Windows 7 clients.
Yes.
How do they connect to the internet access through regular VPN in the direct access
panel? Yeah, so the way the story is going to work is that for Windows 7 clients, you know, they would use direct access. Okay. For, let's say, Vista clients, they would use a traditional VPN. So our RAS product, for example, and we support a traditional L2TP IPsec or SSTP, which was a or third-party, you know, VPN clients and products. So we wouldn't have a direct access experience that we would target for the down-level clients. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay, great. So for data protection, we use IPsec. It allows us to have authentication of the session itself, so kind of actual good attestation as to the identity of the machine and the identity of the user that is engaging in this communication session. And then we also have full encryption potentially from both the client to the edge of the network where the direct access server would sit, and then optionally even end-to-end. So we fully support this idea that the long-term vision is that your policies internally would be very similar to the policies that you would have externally. And so if you have a desire for very strong identity of who is accessing what in your environment, well, you probably want to think about how to do that even for your internal assets. And so you can deploy, for example, IPsec inside of the network, either just in the authentication-only mode with no encryption, or with optional encryption as well. And then when the client moves to the outside of the network, we would protect the client-to-edge communication, and then we would have the IPsec running end-to-end inside of that client-to-edge protection as well. And so we have a lot of options for how to protect the communication. So we're tightly integrated with V6, so you can do end-to-end V6, and you can do end-to-end IPsec if your environment is capable of doing that. And this is really kind of the long-term sort of vision of direct access, is to move to an end-to-end sort of model. So name resolution. This was asked about earlier, so I promised a couple slides on this. So the way it's going to work is that the client machine itself, we supplemented the local DNS table with the address ranges, the address spaces, I should say, of our corporate network. So if our corporate network is corp.microsoft.com, for example, I would create an entry on the client machine that would first, when you use a short name, append that suffix to those short names and then attempt a corporate DNS resolution over our secure channel to an existing DNS server in the inside of your network to see if that would be able to resolve. And then if that doesn't resolve, then the client would fall back to the local DNS server provided by the local ISP, whatever organization you're at, or potentially fall back to other name resolution mechanisms for, say, you're on your home network and you want to use LNMNR or NetBIOS or these kind of things. So we've tried to do the blend the best of both, that you're going to be able to get secure access to the things back in your corporate network, but have direct access to local resources or internet resources as well in a way that's very, very simple for users to understand. So it's very efficient, very effective. Now, so the model here, by default on the client, is what you might refer to as split tunneled. So corporate traffic goes to corp, name resolution traffic for corp directly goes to corp, and internet traffic goes directly to the internet. Now, you can disable that on a direct access client and force everything to route back through the corporate network, just like you can with many VPN products today, but that's not the default config for direct access. All right. And then we'll have another drill down slide on NRPT coming up. Okay. So requirements for direct access. So as I mentioned before, the client itself is going to be our enterprise or ultimate client SKUs. They're going to need to be domain joined. The customer themselves today with the direct access, we assume a basic knowledge of TCP/IP. The wizard is not necessarily as easy as it is with other sort of remote access technologies, and so we are assuming kind of a little more experience for the IT pro that's using the wizard than one might expect today. This is where UAG helps out a little bit because they've taken the wizard and they've streamlined it a little bit more, made it easier for users. You need at least one Windows Server 2008 R2 server, all right, that runs as the direct access server. It's the standard edition or higher, so it's not the enterprise service queue or anything like that. As I mentioned, the machine, the server itself would be domain joined. And then we need at least one DNS server to support our direct access clients running Server 2008 SP2 or later. So only the direct access server needs to be upgraded to R2, or the release associated with Windows 7. We can use the prior release DNS server as well. You don't have to upgrade the DNS server. And then for all the IPsec stuff we're doing, we do require a certificate authority to be present, and because we use machine certificates to protect the initial communication used for the direct access client. Okay. A little more detail. Okay. So how does this connectivity work? So let's start off with, you got this client sitting at some public location, some Starbucks, things like that. So they're going to get an IP address that's assigned by the local ISP. And it might be native, but probably low chance that's going to happen, again, unless you're in Asia someplace or in France, or you're starting to see more and more prevalence of native 6 being deployed. If native is available and the direct access server is sitting at a company where they have inbound V6 available to it, we would just use native. So that's our preferred by default connectivity mechanism. But since most don't have that, we're going to use a variety of transition technologies from the client to the direct access server. And the first one on the list here is a technology called 6-to-4. So for example, you might have an IGD that provides 6-to-4 capabilities for the clients. Those are becoming increasingly popular, if you will, and if you have this capability on the direct access server. So what this does is that it takes that V6 packet, puts it inside of a traditional V4 packet, and then sends that across the internet. Once it gets to the direct access server, we then strip off the V4 header, and then we have our V6 packet. So as far as the direct access server is concerned, it's just getting a V6 packet over a transition technology.
I mean, you said you gave an acronym IGD or something like that.
Yeah, what a little. So for example, there's some like D-Link routers and the Internet Gateway devices. So Belkin or Apple Airports or there's a variety of these home routers or gateway devices that are increasingly coming with what's called 6-to-4 native capabilities.
Are they? I mean, because I was just looking at various routers and I didn't see that in any of the feature sets in there.
Well, a lot of them don't even put it on their little checklist, if you will, even though they have the capability to do it, because it's not something that consumers today really kind of understand fully. But we're seeing a trend in this direction, but it's still not a huge percentage. I'm not going to say it's a huge percentage by any stretch of the imagination, which is why we then have another mechanism we'll use. But before I explain that, you have a question.
I'm curious. Does the Microsoft corporate outbound firewall allow protocol 41 for
question? Okay, yeah, I'll repeat the question. Yeah, so the question is, are we allowing protocol 41 inbound, 6-to-4 inbound, to the Microsoft corporate network? Yeah. So we actually, I'm going to ask my technical guys. So I don't think we have 6-to-4 wired inbound yet, do we? No. Now, the reason we don't have 6-to-4 wired inbound is because we actually are using this technology internally for quite a while ago. And so whereas direct access isn't really using 6-to-4 on the inside, it's just primarily using 6-to-4 on the outside. So we don't today, and which is why we support what's called Teredo. And the next thing we'll talk about here in a second. So Teredo is a true, doesn't require any sort of it doesn't require protocol 41 inbound. And what it does is takes, again, this V6 packet, puts it inside of a V4 packet, and then ships it off to the direct access server. So this is UDP 3544 inbound port would need to be allowed through the edge perimeter and to be received by the direct access server. So that's the one sort of inbound requirement that would be needed there. And so on our internal pilots, for example, we're using Teredo primarily.
But when you keep saying inbound, but it's inbound and outbound, right? I mean, you have to
transition
both ways.
That's correct.
My experience, neither of those is allowed by most corporate firewalls, neither UDP nor protocol 41. So I'm curious to know what kind of success you're going to have. Now, obviously, my data is a little bit old, but I'm curious, has this been an issue?
So far, no. For Teredo, it's not been an issue. Companies have allowed us to do that. And the ones that have not, then we have, ones that are ultra uber paranoid, only allowing SSL inbound, and that's where our additional protocol we created for Windows 7 called IP-HTTPS kind of kicks in. And so this is why it hasn't been a problem per se, because we have a story dependent upon the customer's particular preference on their edge firewalls. And so this is something that most of them are allowing today through traditional sort of SSL VPNs, need this capability, and so we're able to do something very similar to that. So think of this as a lightweight version of the SSTP protocol that we shipped in the Vista Server 2008 sort of time frame.
So this IP-HTTPS, does it have performance problems? Or if you're doing video streaming or something like that?
Yeah, so great question. So obviously you're doing a full level of packet encapsulation there that you don't have with the other technologies, because there you're just changing the headers, whereas here we're doing a full packet. So you're absolutely right that there's more overhead there. However, we haven't seen it be a problem in terms of client experiences like video streaming and these kind of things. Where it does have more of an impact is on the scalability of the direct access server itself, right? And so the number of clients that you're going to support, if you're 100% of them are using this, is going to be lower than if you had a mix of clients using Teredo and some using IP-HTTPS. So our internal pilot, where we do allow Teredo inbound, For example, we have about 12,000 users on the corporate network using Direct Access today. And it's about a 65% are using Teredo, and kind of the 35 end up using IP HTTPS because of their behind at a hotel or at an airport or a corporate network that only allows SSL outbound. And so it's an important consideration, very important consideration.
Will functions work equally well through all of them?
Yeah. The question was, do all of the direct access functions work equally well over all of these technologies? And the answer is yes, is that because we designed it starting with v6, and then we use IPsec as our security technology, these additional technologies are simply an interesting way to get the packet to the server. And so we're not necessarily focused on SSL as our authentication mechanism, if you will, as much as it is a convenient transport mechanism for us. And then all of the other all the capabilities that we use to support, like for example, two-factor authorization, are all based on IPsec, and so they work the same regardless of which of the transition technologies you're using. With the point that I made a moment ago, that 100% IP HTTPS deployment would have lower scalability on the direct access server, so not as well.
Yeah.
But so on the inside of the network. To kind of continue this diagram, well, you in theory could support native v6 on the inside of your network and use v6 kind of end-to-end. All right? You could use these transition technology devices we talked about, like the NAT-PT or the NAT-64 protocol. And then the other thing we support on the inside is a protocol called ISATAP. So this is a capability of, again, putting a v6 packet inside of a v4 packet, transiting it all the way across an existing v4 infrastructure, and the v6 packet actually is decoded, encapsulated at the endpoint. So our server 2008 and higher, plus third parties, support ISATAP protocol, for example. And so you can do V6 end-to-end in that model without a transition device. You had a question?
Can we actually go back to the previous slide? We've not covered how the client cover gets to the actual server itself or to the DA servers. How you know to go there, how you pick the IP address that you're going to go through, how you know it's V4 or V6.
So let me answer that question on my NRPT slide, and I'll actually walk through a packet flow, because I think that's where it's going to start. Okay. Any more questions on this, though? And I'll come back and answer and kind of do a complete walkthrough kind of end-to-end. All right.
So are you going to do an ISATAP explanation a little bit?
Well, I'm not going to dive into it a tremendous amount. I mean, it's a capability we've had in the product for quite a while. So 2008, for example, could be an ISATAP server. And once you enable this, what it does is that it simply gives all of the devices that support ISATAP on the inside a V6 address. Then they're able to communicate inside the network by putting the V6 packet inside of a V4 packet, if you will, not a full encapsulation, similar to what we saw with 6-to-4 or Teredo. Now, it's not necessarily widely deployed, because we only recently supported it in our product line. But it is a technology that allows a customer to kind of very simply start using V6 on the inside of the network, even if their routers and IDS and APS devices may not natively support V6. So as long as they support V4, we can take that ISATAP packet and take it over that existing infrastructure. So when you deploy the Direct Access server, by default, it configures itself as an ISATAP server. And so server 2008 or higher will then automatically start getting a V6 address from the ISATAP server, for example, in a network. So did that answer that question?
Yeah, more or less. I mean, the reason why I say this is because
in most of the documentation, ISATAP seems to be the preferred Microsoft solution for transition technologies.
Certainly inside the corporate perimeter, that is correct. Yeah. Yeah, that is certainly our preference. And Direct Access uses that as its preferred protocol internally.
Thank you.
Okay. What I'm going to do, I'm going to do my slide in a slightly different order in order to answer your question. Okay? All right. So name resolution policy table. So this is an example of what the NRPT might look like, for example, on a client machine. AD.contoso.com, some sort of, you might have sub-organizational units here. At Microsoft, for example, the NRPT contains a corp prefix, so corp.microsoft.com. Then it would have a listing of the V6 addresses of the internal DNS servers that would be used by the clients on the network to, like they normally would when they're registering their addresses. So whatever DNS server you have deployed today, as long as you've deployed one DNS server that is Server 2008 SP2 or higher, or one that is compatible with getting Quad A records, all right, then we would be able to work with that infrastructure. So we do have customers, for example, that are using Bind internally, for example, as their DNS server, and we are interoperable there. And so this is the first thing that happens on the client. So when the client types in an FQDN, the client machine, the DNS stack looks at the name the client's typed in. If it's an FQDN, then it simply directly sends that query to that address destination. If it is a short name, then we'll actually go through a process of appending these suffixes to the short name and sending those queries here. So at that point, you have a Quad A, a V6 lookup that's being done destined to that address. So it's destined to a V6 address. So at that point, the client presumably has already gotten a V6 address assigned to it, either through Teredo or through IP-HTTPS, or it was by the direct access server, if it did not get a native or a 6-to-4 address qualified as the client was resuming from sleep or turning on. So that's the first thing. So the client, as it comes up, gets a V6 address, either native or 6-to-4 assigned. If those don't qualify, then Teredo will try to kick in and get a V6 address from the direct access server acting as a Teredo server. If that doesn't qualify, then IP-HTTPS tries to qualify and get a V6 address assigned to it from the direct access server acting as the IP-HTTPS server. So we've gotten a V6 address assigned to the client. So now we have a connectivity for V6 and routes for V6 available on the client. This Quad A record then uses those routes and creates a packet destined to this location. The IPsec policies are constructed to such that they have a policy that says from the client, location or any location to this address space, the client has to then create an IPsec tunnel to the V6 destination of the direct access server. So then that Quad A record would be put inside of an IPsec tunnel. That IPsec tunnel might go over SSL through IP-HTTPS, gets destined to the direct access server. The direct access server decapsulates that packet, takes the packet out of the IPsec tunnel, sees it's destined to the internal DNS server, then puts that packet back on the wire, sends it off to the DNS server. And then, of course, the response happens in the opposite fashion. So that's kind of the end-to-end sort of packet flow of how the client would get a Quad A lookup for the destination. So when I typed in direct access SharePoint site, then DNS gave me the V6 address of that destination. We then create an HTTP GET packet request to that destination, which then followed a similar packet flow going inside of the IPsec tunnel, then to the destination, and the response came back. So that's kind of the end-to-end sort of flow. Did that answer your question, or you want to go through more details there? Happy to do so.
That's the first question I have for
all that. Yeah, okay, good. All right. Did answer your, you had a second one I haven't answered yet?
Yes, I'm not sent one yet. How did I determine? How did I, as a client, did I determine
where or how I established that first tunnel?
Okay.
At some point, I have to do a DNS resolution or go to a particular address in order, be it V4 or V6, to create that tunnel with the direct access server.
Yes.
I'm assuming that's configured, but...
So what happens is that when you configure direct access in an environment, the client gets a group policy assigned to it that eventually gets down to the client machine. So the idea is that you have these group policies that are on the client, and as soon as the machine turns on, even before the user is logged in, we actually establish the IPsec tunnel to the direct access server, and we're able to then communicate to the domain controllers over that secure channel, so right up front.
Direct access server?
Yeah, because the policy is given, it's configured.
It's configured. That's why.
By the IT department.
So the first thing I'm going to do is a DNS resolution for who is my direct access server, or it's going to be a straight IP address that's V4 or V6.
Yeah, so what will happen actually, let me back up here, on that front. Okay. So what we said was, first, we're going to get a V6 address. So connectivity is key first. I need a V6 address. It's going to happen via native or 6-to-4. But even before IPsec kicks in, we need a V6 address.
How do I get my V6 address? It's
right, I'm walking
native.
Through that. So either it's native, which means you're sitting at an ISP or at home, that's the ISP is providing you a native V6 address, or you have a gateway device that's providing you a 64 address. So upon machine resume, that's just automatically going to happen. You'll get an address assigned. If those two methods don't work, then the client is configured through group policy for an FQDN or an IP address of a Teredo server and an IP HTTPS server. If those two methods don't work, the native or 64, it will then use that FQDN. It'll resolve that to an IP address, and so the Teredo.corp.microsoft.com or IPHTTPS.corp.microsoft.com FQDNs would be externally hosted via DNS and resolved to a V4 address. The client would then communicate to that V4 address over a V4 network, asking for a V6 address to be assigned to it. The direct access server, acting as the Teredo server or the IPHTTPS server, would then give it a V6 address through an address pool that's been configured on the direct access server, an address range that's been defined as you went through the direct access wizard, that then gets to the client. The client then uses that address as its V6 address. And so that's how the connectivity bit happens. Then you have some higher level services for example, the client workstation service that looks for domain controllers, for example. And so it does a query to DNS for SRV records for all of the DCs that are in that client's domain, for example. Those then kick off the communication flow that I described earlier of a series of quad A lookups that then cause IPsec tunnels to then be established to the edge so that we can get access to the destinations at that point. So did that answer the question or no? If I'm not, I'm willing to do it again. I'm willing to try to, because it's important for me to you guys that you guys feel comfortable in the technical details here versus the marketing slides.
That answers the question. I think the only thing I would try to look at is the protocol that you use to negotiate your tunnel with, which probably is an RFC spec.
So when you say that we have the connectivity tunnel, right? So
the negotiation to get the tunnel is the only thing.
So when you say tunnels, you mean IPsec, right?
No, I mean the 64 tunnel.
Ah, okay. So that's all RFC?
That's RFC, yes.
Yeah, okay. It's all RFC. No, we're not doing anything unique there.
If you have multiple corporate environments in a multinational, are you configured with multiple DA servers? How do you route between them, or do you always go through one DA server and then route through from there?
Yeah, okay, great question. I'll repeat the question. The question, let me describe as kind of the multi-site question, all right, where you might have, if you have, let's say, a North America location, a Europe location, you might have a direct access server at each of those locations. So we are in the process right now of publishing guidance on the web for that particular configuration. The short answer is there's lots of ways to address that scenario depending upon the particular organization's infrastructure capabilities. So one way, for example, to handle that is, as I mentioned earlier, for example, with the Teredo FQDN and IPHTTPS FQDN, some organizations can do geo-load balancing instances of that, where they give them an IP address that's locally relevant to the direct access server based off where their client is located at. The other way to approach that would be potentially separate group policy objects, depending upon where the client is at the majority of time. So if they're primarily in North America, they would bootstrap through North America, and then Teredo, using its relay capabilities, would then find the shortest path for ongoing communication, potentially, through Europe, even though it may have initially gotten its address from a North America Teredo server. So it's kind of a complex answer. I think the white paper is about 60 pages. We're getting ready to ship. But the point, though, is that we do have a story for that, but it depends on the capabilities of the customer as to how easy it would be to deploy that and maintain that.
Well, the one thing that you're...
It's not on, I don't think.
It's trying to be on. It just doesn't come on.
Ah, okay. All right, I'll read the question then for the recording.
So the good solutions that you've mentioned, i.e., you know, GSLB or some other variant thereof, redirection, have to do with either HTTPS or Teredo, which there's an explicit tunnel. But in the quote-unquote ideal solution, mm-hmm. IPv6 or 6-4, I don't see how you solve that.
Okay. So let's take the native case. All right. So in the native case, I just get a V6 address. And in that case, I have a couple options. I can have my IPsec policies based off of my geographic destinations. So for example, the V6 address range that you set aside for North America, you would say from me to North America address range, tunnel to an entry point for North America. From my me to Europe range, tunnel to my Europe entry point, so that you would then have direct connections to those entry points, depending upon, and that gives a kind of a route over the internet kind of model. Some corporations may not like that, and so they may use a route over court model, as we call it, where they just want to pick a particular destination. And there it gets a little more tricky, because then you would have a me to entire corp range policy tunnel to a destination. That destination today is an IP address. And so that IP address potentially would have to be, in, if we're in the native case here, you could use something that would allow that same address to be used in multiple locations. So in theory, for example, you may be able to do things like Anycast support. But we're not obviously there yet. Yeah, not at this stage. Not at this stage. And so most likely you're dealing with the IPsec policies that are range-based, based off the entry point you're trying to talk to today. Sure? So, all right. So I think I've actually jumped ahead of a lot of this stuff already. So this is the picture trying to show how, for example, you might have an IP-HTTPS connection. Inside of that, you're going to have your encrypted IPsec tunnel communicating to the direct access server. We also support the capability of having a dedicated IPsec gateway potentially sitting behind the direct access server. So if you wanted to offload the IPsec termination to another server or another device, for example, that might allow you to be a terminal terminator, that support is possible. And Intel has a hardware accelerator as well for IPsec that we can take advantage of as well.
So what is the sequence? So I suppose the native one is the first thing that you take a crack at, right?
Yes.
So what is the next one?
I mean, what is it that you prefer effectively?
Yeah, the preference order is going to be native.
Yeah.
6-4, Teredo, then IP-HTTPS.
I see.
That would be kind of the preference order. Okay, great question. All right. So, and then an internal IPsec. So in our default configuration, the IPsec would terminate at the direct access server, and we would use clear packets on the inside. However, you know, if an organization wanted to do so, we do support doing either, in addition to no IPsec, we have the capability of doing just integrity only. Right? So yeah, like ESP null, AH, IPsec transport mode policies to the destinations, or you know, full ESP encapsulated packets as well. And one thing the slide doesn't show, but I'll talk about, is we actually have a new option in Windows 7 and Windows Server 2008 R2 that we've added to IPsec, where we have the capability of doing an IPsec authentication only, and then we negotiate after we do that successfully to clear. And so the idea there is that you might have infrastructure that doesn't have the capability of inspecting ESP null packets, you know, or AH packets. And so when you use integrity only, it still potentially presents problems for some intermediate inspection devices. And so we do have the capability now of doing what would a traditional AH or ESP null style integrity check. But then instead of sending the packets, continuing to send them over IPsec, at that point we'll actually fall back that session to clear. And so all of your traffic shapers and other devices for cache optimizations and those kind of things would still be able to work. So it's kind of a hybrid option that's available in only if the destination supports that capability. But it's fully documented in our protocol spec.
What is defined as a session here? A security association between two endpoints?
That's correct. So what defined a session? And it was a traditional IPsec SA. All right. So this slide is designed to talk in more detail about the IPsec tunnel. So far I've been describing it as a single thing. In reality, it's actually two things. We actually have, by default, at least two tunnels, potentially more, that are created. The first tunnel, we would think of this in an AppNAC world as kind of your quarantine network. What are the set of resources the client can get to before they've been able to fully authenticate to the network? When the machine boots, we're going through the sequence that I mentioned earlier, and even before the user's logged in, we're automatically going to bring up this first tunnel. It's protected with the machine certificate, you know, computer certificate, and machine in TLM. And the idea behind this first tunnel is that you would list a set of your domain controllers, maybe your WAS and SUS or SSEM servers, antivirus servers that contain your signature updates, whatever the set of resources that are needed in order to keep that client kind of always up to date, always healthy, always manageable, even if users aren't logged in. Then, as the user logs in, will actually do an interactive logon session over this first tunnel with your domain controllers in the back end. We'll get, for example, their Kerberos ticket, user's Kerberos ticket. And then in the user session, as we're setting up what we call our second tunnel or the everything else tunnel, we'll actually then, in addition to the computer certificate we used in the first tunnel, we'll also then use user curb to protect this tunnel. So, and then this would just generally be the everything else on the network tunnel. And this is where, for example, on this tunnel, you could additionally require stronger health attestation. You could also require stronger user authentication, like smart card authentication, for example, would be required here.
So why is that NTLM?
I mean, the first one, why is it NTLM?
So the way IPsec works is it has what's called an auth1 method and an auth2 method. And our auth1 method, our primary and our key strength, is around is based off of our computer certificate here. The auth2 method of machine NTLM, we have added there as a supplement for a remediation stolen laptop scenario. Because if we only protected it with a computer certificate, let's say this device was lost or stolen, you have the capability of revoking certificates, but customers tell us that's quite a pain for them today. A lot of customers don't have a good computer certificate revocation sort of process worked out. And so by using machine NTLM there, you can simply go into Active Directory, you can disable the machine account, and then it would fail to establish the first tunnel. And so it allows us a really quick and convenient choke point for that, even though, and so we're not really using it for a strong sort of attestation because all the existing issues with NTLM, and that's why you would want to use curb.
Yeah.
And so the real security here is off of computer certificate, and machine NTLM gives us a nice remediation choke point. So great question. Are there any other questions on this slide? No? All right. Cool. All right, we talked about NRPT, so I think we're good there. All right, so the one thing that I can do on NRPT is to show kind of the policy. All right. So the command, is our NetSSH name show policy. And so here's kind of an example of, the settings for corp.microsoft.com that I'm using in our pilot. And I can see this is also if you were interested in DNSSEC. DNSSEC is interoperable here as well for direct access. I'm listing my servers. And I can see if there's additional IPsec policies that are desired, that they are supported here as well. And I can actually have a per destination name proxy setting, for example. So some organizations have a split-brain DNS, and you need very unique configurations for when you're inside, the name should map to one location. When you're outside, the name should map to another location. And this gives us that fine-grain sort of capability. A good example might be like Bing.com. Well, while it was under development, if you were inside Microsoft's corporate network, Bing.com went to an internal test server. But when you're outside, Bing.com should go to some public, non-resolvable site at that point. And so you can actually have per name, sort of proxy settings and behaviors that you can configure to really kind of customize and control the environment. There's also another command I'd like to show called NetSSH DNS show state. So at any point in time, I could actually see kind of what is going on in my client machine right now. And I can see that it'll use direct access, so it's been configured, and it's currently active, enabled. And this is an important point because when the client comes back to the inside of the network, we don't want all of the communication to try to route back to the outside of the DA server. So we need to disable some of the tunnel policies, for example, when the client has entered the corporate perimeter. So we have a detection mechanism that we use to figure out that we're on the inside of the corporate network, and we change our policies accordingly. So I can actually see right now I appear to be outside the corporate network, but this would then change if I entered the corporate perimeter, and our policies would match appropriately. And I can also change the behavior of the query resolution preference and fallback behavior. So for example, if the direct access server, an internal DNS server, is not available, you can choose to allow the client not to fall back to local name resolution methods, or you could choose to allow it to fall back to name resolution mechanisms. There's various attacks, for example. Someone could spoof internal locations from public locations, and so you have a lot of control over how the fallback behavior occurs. Okay. So we do support multi-factor authentication, but the only multi-factor authentication we support today in Box is smart card credentials. And we have two ways that users can provide the smart cards. You can start off by allowing the user just to log in when they're outside with their name and password. And what would happen is the first tunnel would spin up. They would be still manageable and healthy, but they would not have user mode access to any of the corporate internal resources. When they tried to access those resources, it would attempt to spin up the second tunnel, right, to access those destinations. And it would fail if you had required smart card authentication. And it would actually cause a balloon to appear on the client saying, hey, we need your smart card credentials. Click here. We'll give them a little pin prompt. They can put in their smart card credentials. And then it would finish setting up the rest of that communication. This is designed kind of as a nice graduated kind of step-up experience. The users, if they know they want to access something on the corp network, they could choose to bypass this and just unlock directly with the smart card. And then there's no additional user sort of experience that's required. We'd use the smart card credentials, successfully establish the second tunnel, and they have access to the corporate network. So you can choose to allow them to log in with the smart card or not to allow to log in with the smart card in the environment. What we do not support in Box is one-time passwords, OTPs. And so it's one of the sort of big areas of opportunities that I'll talk about in a moment that we think for our partners to potentially provide added value here. Okay. So in terms of when we talk to customers, what we kind of talk to them about in terms of preparing for direct access, as you saw, there's a lot of moving parts here. All right. We try to make it as simple as possible for customers, but you know, we will prefer V6 traffic to be on the inside of the network, things like ISOTAP, for example, to ISOTAP-capable devices. And so they need to be aware of this, and they need to make sure that if this occurs, that if they have any IDS, IPS systems on the inside of their network, that they can handle inspection of this encapsulated traffic, where you have V6 traffic potentially inside of V4 traffic or native V6 flowing over the network. And there's a lot of products that aren't ready for that yet. It'll start setting off alarms and tripping alerts. And so we want to make sure customers are fully aware of what would happen there. We got to figure out how many servers they need, what the scale is. We're still working on real crisp guidance for this for customers today. But your typical direct access server with kind of commodity hardware, some 4-core, 4 gig of RAM, supports around 750 users approximately. And so we can scale up and beyond around that. All right, deployment process, prepare infrastructure. So you need to have a direct access server. It's going to be dual homed. It's going to need to be joined to the domain. You need to have ingress ports allowed on the front end firewalls for the protocols. And so we have a ton of documentation out on that public website I mentioned before. But the easy URL to remember literally is www.directaccess.com. So we actually have the vanity plate. And so you can go to that and redirect to our public portal. So let me just kind of show that. So microsoft.com/directaccess or directaccess.com will reroute to the server site. And so we have literally a ton of videos and white papers and step-by-step guides so that you can set this up in a lab environment. So for example, from here, I'll go to our TechNet site. And we have literally a ton of content up here about how the net location works, what our thin edge vision is, how to set up a demo lab for this. Okay. All right. So I do want to talk just briefly about kind of where Microsoft sees a kind of partner opportunities to leverage all of this marketing effort that you see behind Direct Access. And the kind of the game-changing capability that we think this extending the network concept out to the users provides in terms of changing how organizations manage their network. The first opportunity, obviously, is to ship a direct access server, either as part of a blade in an appliance device that's running the full Windows operating system, or potentially the UAG products as an element within that blade. That's the kind of the easiest kind of go-to-market for a lot of folks. But then you could take a look at kind of the next step of integration, and that's literally implementing the edge components that we've provided as part of the direct access server directly in your appliances. So instead of us terminating it on a Microsoft server, we'd literally terminate these on an appliance, on a non-Microsoft appliance. So all of the protocols that we use for our IPsec capabilities, for IP HTTPS capabilities, are all documented as part of the open protocol specification, and we're very willing to work with you to have us allow to allow us to directly terminate these capability these sessions on your appliance. So from our point of view, we see this as a client and an endpoint server strategy. We don't necessarily see this as a huge focus for us, Microsoft internally, to go build a huge edge business here. Instead, what we'd like to do is work with the partners to have you work with us to provide this edge capability to allow customers then to experience this kind of new framework around how they manage policy and security kind of in the network environment. And so this is kind of the key strategy for us and why we're kind of talking to you here today. Stepping back from that, which might be a kind of a large first step for some, you could look at some of these other areas of interoperability, one of them potentially being the NAT64, NAT PT, and DNS ALG devices that would be able to be used to bridge the communication to existing V4 networks. You know, many of you have sort of a place in the network architecture that would be very well suited to this capability, and we fully support third-party products in this space. Where it gets a little tricky is that the NAT PT RFC itself has been deprecated, and there's a lot of work within the IETF on the replacement for the NAT PT, and which is why I've used the phrase NAT64 as well as NAT PT here. And so it's somewhat of a moving target, but there is fairly solid draft standards that are out now as to recommended ways to do this that you potentially could implement. One of the things we said was, a client-to-edge story is interesting and important for us as a first step, but as part of a long-term roadmap to an end-to-end state vision, and to that extent, we want to be able to make sure we have IPsec support all the way to the endpoint in the network environment and V6 capabilities here. So Microsoft is only going to provide IPsec capabilities to the endpoint for Microsoft operating systems. However, we do truly want to interoperate with Linux and other non-Microsoft operating systems and be able to support transport mode IPsec end-to-end. Now, the default mechanism that we use for IPsec client-to-edge is our auth-IP implementation of IPsec. However, we do fully support what's called an IKEv1 implementation of transport mode IPsec to these destinations here. And there actually is at least one partner that's publicly announced a product that does provide interoperability in this space. It's Centrify's Direct Secure product for transport mode IPsec to about, I think it's something like 160 different flavors of Unix and Linux. And I think that we think this is a good partner opportunity as well. I think you're jumping at the bit for a question there.
The problem with IPsec is that it blows away all the acceleration capabilities along the way. So what is Microsoft willing to do in that regard?
Yeah, so the question was, what about WAN accelerators? So we have this feature called Branch Cache, which we're also working with a number of our partners around. And it's kind of a different way to think about sort of WAN acceleration. And we could actually have a complete drill down on our branch cache functionality. And Manish would be able to kind of maybe kind of arrange that drill down. But that's basically our strategy, where we're going to allow, imagine, let's say you had a branch office hanging down here somewhere and inside the network, and you still want to use IPsec. So what you would have is a peer a cache that is located at the branch that would still be able to interoperate with IPsec. So instead of getting in the middle of the IPsec session, we actually cache outside of that communication pathway. So, we think we have a good story there, but it would require a bit of drill down on the branch cache feature.
It seems to me that the branch cache, I've had some discussions with Microsoft, and branch cache seems to be a caching solution at the application protocol level, mm-hmm. rather than, so I don't know whether it still solves the problem, but
yeah, it depends on the workload. So branch cache, you're right, is an application-level cache capability. Today, it supports HTTP and SMB, which we think are the big targets there. And we're working with third parties to provide additional app support for that. But, you're right. That's the common battle, if you will, with an end-to-end IPsec vision, which is why in Win7 and Server 2008, the other feature we talked about was this capability to initially authenticate using IPsec and then negotiate to clear, which then would be fully interoperable with those WAN accelerators. And so we've also tried to address that particular concern in addition to branch cache through changes in IPsec. Clearly, where we want to go long term is V6 on the inside, to the extent that your products support V6 and V6 transition technologies like ISATAP. You'll be kind of aligned to that vision, and there's opportunities there that we would co-market potentially. And then we're talking with some partners around client improvements. So client accelerators, client improvements for strong auth, OTP support, for example, are big areas of interest for us currently. And what we definitely want to encourage partner development in. Okay. And then I drew a big circle around the whole thing, and that's because of reporting and monitoring. So earlier, the things that I said was we want to have policy based off of the users and what they're trying to access, not based off the topology. And so to that extent, we think there's a large opportunity on end-to-end reporting and end-to-end monitoring of this. So who is accessing not only what at the edge and help provide direct access and enhanced reporting here, but also looking at the end-to-end sort of reporting and monitoring and for HIPAA and SOX compliance and these kind of things. And we're very interested in partner opportunities for improvements for remote reporting and monitoring at the edge, as well as holistically throughout the entire enterprise. Okay. All right. So three slides left and we're done. So one of the kind of the high-level point is with direct access, we want to kind of build trust into the network fabric itself, build trust into have these strong clients with high level of integrity because they're always up to date, they're always healthy, they have strong authentication possible, their domain controller authenticated as often as possible instead of staying in this cache mode, offline state, non-healthy, not getting updated. So the idea is that only if the computer is not connected to a network would they now have to use these offline cache credential sort of mechanisms. So we're able to enforce password rotations and these kind of things much more often than you can traditionally. So we're able to have really strong clients, be able to know who they are and the fact that they are who they say they are. Access controls, so we want to then be able to leverage this identity at the edge, so kind of an identity-aware firewall, if you will, so that it's not just based off of the machine, but it's the machine plus the user. Be able to transport that connection securely across the network. And then you can leverage that identity all the way to the app layer at the endpoint server now that you've securely established that out on the client. So you can say things, for example, certain servers are only allowed to be accessed by members of the HR users group, and that policy can apply centrally to all the resources on that server. You could then be able to do that more granularly to specific shares, specific files. But the idea is that you have this identity model kind of from client all the way through the edge to the server holistically, to each of the shares on the server, within the share, to each of the files on the server, and be able to maintain this identity sort of traceability from start to finish. And then be able to audit that end to end. Okay. All right. And I've kind of drilled this point home, I think, enough time, so I'll leave it there. Again, direct access is about not just the client experience that I demoed, but also that manage out experience, so that always keeping that client up to date and healthy. Okay. We had a slide on the protocol, on the partner opportunities. We think there's a lot of opportunity here for a partner ecosystem to be developed. There's a great monetization model that we'd like to work with you on in terms of building an edge business that supports direct access. And we have documented all of the interface specifications as part of the Open Protocol program. And so part of the effort here is to make sure that you're aware of that and then work with you kind of one-on-one at what you would need in order to be able to leverage this documentation and this capability. All right. And then I pointed out some of the websites for direct access, and then later you'll be getting a talk from UAG where they're kind of talk about in more detail kind of how they provide value on top of this. So, and that's pretty much it. So we've got about 15 minutes left for any more questions, or we can let you out for your lunch a little early. Yeah?
Do you guys test your IPsec interoperability with, like, VPNC or anyone?
So the short answer is We haven't actually hosted an interoperability white paper in quite a while. We did an interoperability project back in 2003. We actually have a white paper on our IPsec interoperability that we published. So all the IPv1, interoperable capabilities were done at that time. Last year, we participated in an IPv2 interoperability program for the VPN capabilities, and so we're willing to support those kind of efforts, but we don't have a current paper or a current interoperability study for kind of Win 7 Server 2008 timeframe at this time. All right, but like I said, we're closely working with our partners at Interoperable Solutions. So like I mentioned before, like Centrify's Direct Secure product, for example, 160 flavors of end-to-end interoperability between our operating system and those operating systems for IPv1. Yeah.
What about XP clients? What can they do?
They're great XP clients.
That's it.
I mean, the market
has a lot of XP sitting there, and many corporations use that. So what about...
Yes. That is a great opportunity to upgrade those customers to Windows 7. Yes. So I don't want to be facetious, but we had to make changes to IPsec and the core TCP stack and to DNS and group policy and the user experience and curb, and I mean the list is literally 50 pages long of the features that had to be tweaked and adjusted in the operating system in order to make this kind of experience work end to end. And it's just, at an engineering level, just cost prohibitive to consider backporting this to Vista, let alone to XP. And so the story for XP and Vista is you're using VPN today, you probably continue to use VPN, and when you want to experience these capabilities, then we would encourage you to either upgrade to Windows 7. In the meantime, you could use something like UAG to offer this capability to Windows 7 clients while offering traditional VPN for the down-level clients. So that's it. You guys fully understand the process now, right? Ready to go? Let's start shipping products.
Any other questions?
All right. That's cool. Thank you very much for your time. And we'll be around for lunch. And feel free to grab myself or our engineering team here. And I'm more than happy to drill into this in more detail. Thanks a lot.
Thanks to Scott.